Washington to Florida, Kansas to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it has become obvious the so-called Inflation Reduction Act is merely cover for expanded spending on Green New Deal-type policies. Darren Bask of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with details. Control of the United States Senate is up for grabs in 2024, and races in a number of states are beginning to heat up. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. China's government-run economy is showing signs of distress, and that is a lesson for American policymakers. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the U.S. Constitution gives defendants a right to a speedy trial, but also the right to adequate legal counsel. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why this could be helpful to Donald Trump. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. On the one-year anniversary of passage of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, it has become clear the legislation was more about promoting a green energy agenda than curbing inflation. To learn more, we turn to Darren Bask. He is director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Darren, we have passed the one-year anniversary now of the Inflation Reduction Act, so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which actually included a lot of Green New Deal-type components. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of the act.
A lot of money is being spent to try to get people out of their gas-powered vehicles and into electric vehicles. They're trying to basically subsidize a lot of big companies to try to produce those electric vehicles, make it easier for them, and then as a result, kind of disincentivize them to continue to produce gas-powered vehicles. We say, I mean, the bigger issue might be, and probably is, the same types of incentives or subsidies being used to disincentivize the use of reliable electricity and instead incentivize unreliable and expensive electricity like solar and wind. So the law is effectively putting us in a position where we're going to have less reliable electricity. It's trying to be heavy-handed by getting us out of cars, and in many ways trying to just dictate across the board how we live.
Taking a look at reliable electricity, Darren, and of course you have a national perspective on this, the fact that we have the Biden administration pushing very heavily for these electric vehicles and wanting us to use electric rather than gas stoves and all sorts of other intrusive regulations that they are trying to put forth, are we also building the type of power plants that we're going to need to provide all this electricity as more and more vehicles are using electric as fuel?
No, I think that's the kind of the one of the ironies of a lot of it. And I think there's just, first of all, there's kind of this belief that you just put on solar and wind and then magically everything is great. And the electricity grid is more complicated. You need to have backup electricity generation from conventional sources, which they're not taking into account, like coal, natural gas. If you're not producing them, the ability to even produce enough electricity through these less reliable sources in and of itself, is not, you're not going to be able to do that. So there's this kind of, they're looking at one side of the equation of putting a lot more pressure on trying to generate more electricity. At the same time, on the other side of the equation, they're not doing what's necessary to actually produce more electricity. So it's going to be all kinds of stress on the grid. We're already going to have less reliable sources. We're going to have more demand for electricity. It's a recipe for disaster for Americans.
The Competitive Enterprise Institute, Darren, spearheaded a coalition letter, a letter signed by multiple groups in Washington, D.C., urging Congress to redact or rescind a lot of these Green New Deal type programs from the Inflation Reduction Act. Tell us a little bit about what programs you want to see removed from this act or not acted upon, and this letter, what sort of impact will it have?
Just a little while ago, we had the one-year anniversary, and of course, the Biden administration will be celebrating the passage of the law. Well, we don't think there's anything to celebrate when we're looking at the government spending. It was about $391 billion originally through these programs. It's likely to cost over $1 trillion from recent estimates. That's nothing to celebrate. there's nothing to celebrate when the government is so heavy-handed in trying to control almost every aspect of your life. That's a big problem. And driving up electricity prices and energy prices for all Americans isn't something to celebrate, especially when it's going to have a disproportionate impact on the poor. So that's a problem. We wanted to write a letter. We wanted to make it clear that these policies need to be repealed. And we know that not everything is going to be repealed at one time, especially over the next year or so. But certainly this Congress, even this Congress, can start making a difference and start to at least chip away at the policies in a bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, which was a purely partisan bill. Didn't have one Republican vote for it last year. So I think we want to at least see some progress being made, and ultimately we want to see that all those provisions repealed.
When you talk about the Inflation Reduction Act here, Darren, has it actually done anything to reduce inflation? It seems that a large part of the act was focused on a green agenda rather than an economic agenda.
It basically was always a separate bill, and then they came up with this name after the fact as kind of a marketing tool. But yes, I mean, when you actually do things to drive up prices and to spend more money, you're not going to be reducing inflation. You're doing the exact opposite. So it's really the inflation, increasing inflation, or likely driving up prices. It was a gimmicky name, and it's important for people to recognize that it's misleading.
Just in terms of overall energy policy here, Darren, the fact that you have these hundreds of millions, ultimately billions of dollars, being spent to subsidize electric vehicles, to subsidize so-called green energy, if it was all that great, wouldn't consumers naturally migrate to those technologies? Is it really necessary for the government to be spending all of this money to subsidize something that apparently consumers really don't want?
Yeah, that's a great point. Look, consumers already have a chance to buy EVs. If they want to, they will. The evidence is that they don't as of now. In fact, EV purchases have been heavily subsidized and they don't buy the vehicles. Now, over time, maybe that would change. And it's not like I have some personal opposition to people buying EVs. It's up to them to do so. The same thing goes with like appliances. When we talk about natural gas stoves, and which the government is trying to kind of effectively ban in other appliances. Look, if consumers want these other types of appliances, just that it's electric, we'll do so. We don't need the government to kind of assume that people are not smart enough to make wise choices when it comes to energy efficiency. People are smart enough, and they'll make decisions that make the most sense for them and their families.
Can we realistically expect any progress to be made toward dialing all this back with the current makeup of Congress? Of course, Darren, Republicans control the House, Democrats control the Senate, so the Senate probably unlikely to take up most of this. Is this something that is more going to be a point of policy discussion on the presidential and congressional campaign trails next year?
I think it's going to be very challenging to get something done over the next year, but I think that it's important that the legislators that want to actually push back, try everything in their arsenal to do so. I think there are some possibilities to achieve some victories. They may not be as big as we might hope, but it might be something along the lines of delaying some things, might be getting rid of some smaller programs. I don't know. But the key is to keep plugging away at it and to chip away. Ultimately, I do believe it will be part of the next presidential kind of debate and discussion, and then probably looking at 2025 to really get rid of these programs.
We have been talking with Darren Bask. Darren is director of the Center for Energy and Environment, that at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, tell us a little bit about CEI. Also, obviously, you've done a lot of policy work on this. You've written extensively on these subjects. Where can folks find that on the web?
First of all, CEI is a nonprofit organization. A think tank, and we are committed to reducing the scope of government and the burden of the administrative state. So if you believe in freedom, individual rights, and property rights, I think it'd be a good organization for you to look into. You can find us at CEI.org. It's CEI.org. We have a lot of great information on the site and a good way to learn about us by visiting the website.
Darren Bask of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much.
At the Club for Growth, we, as usual, have Scott Parkinson with us, and today we're going to take a run all around the country and look at key U.S. Senate races. Scott, always good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Republicans have a good shot at the U.S. Senate now, which is almost tied. Republicans down by one seat. But Democrats have a lot more seats up this year, do they not?
They do. And it, I think, gives the Republicans a pretty good opportunity to flip the Senate majority in 2024 and get some good conservatives elected.
Well, let's start out with our state-by-state analysis by going to the state of Texas. Ted Cruz, of course, is one of the most well-known members that almost got elected president a few years back. He is up for re-election in the Lone Star State. Give us the lay of the land there, please.
Recently, Club for Growth PAC endorsed Ted Cruz for his re-election campaign in Texas. There's a primary right now among the Democrats, and there's a sort of conventional wisdom that Colin Allred is going to be the Dem nominee. Allred has been raising a massive amount of money from the Democrat activist community through Act Blue, a lot of low-dollar donors, and I think that it gives him a pretty strong advantage against any of the other Democrats that are running. Allred is a former NFL player. He's been serving in the House of Representatives for a couple of terms and is a young African-American candidate. I think he's exactly the kind of candidate that the Democrats want to run against Ted Cruz. Obviously, Senator Cruz is a former presidential candidate in 2016. He's been one of the conservative leaders in the United States Senate for his first two terms.
That, of course, is a must-keep for Republicans. But Republicans here, Scott, have a number of pickup opportunities. Let's talk about several of them, starting with West Virginia, where the Club for Growth actually has made an endorsement and is doing a bit of advertising.
Club for Growth PAC also endorsed in that race. We've endorsed Congressman Alex Mooney. Representative Mooney has served in the House, I think, for about five terms. And he has been a rock-solid conservative, a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He's running against West Virginia's Governor Jim Justice, a former Democrat turned Republican during the Trump presidency. And there's a big question here on what President Trump is going to do in that race. We know that Mooney is sort of despised by the Republican political establishment, but he's also an incredibly hard worker, and I think that he's got good temperament and policy judgment to be a great senator. We're thrilled about his campaign right now, and we think he's going to defeat Justice in that primary and ultimately face Joe Manchin in the general election. There's also some speculation that Manchin might retire. We're obviously watching that very, very closely to see what this race looks like for the general election.
The state of Montana has had a Democratic senator now for a couple of terms, John Tester. It would seem to me, Scott, that Montana would be a real pickup opportunity. Odd for it to be represented in the Senate by a Democrat.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Montana has gone red for President Trump in 2020 and 2016. In 2018, Congressman Matt Rosendale ran against Senator Tester. That was the off-year election where Republicans didn't do great, but barely maintained the Senate majority. Mr. Rosendale lost a tight race there against Tester. Tester's sort of been perceived as one of these moderate Democrats, but when you unpack his voting record, he's obviously just another one of the socialist Democrats. And Rosendale has won five times statewide. In the Republican primary, Rosendale hasn't made a declaration of his candidacy yet. But there is another candidate named Tim Sheehy, and he's a pretty wealthy business owner, innovator, and served in the military as a SEAL. And there's a lot of people that are pretty excited about him, too. That's going to be one of the more interesting Republican primaries to keep our eyes on when it comes to the 2024 Senate elections. And then you also have a big, big race in Ohio where you have Sherrod Brown, Democrat that is running for re-election, and Ohio is another one of those red states that's gone for President Trump twice, and people think that's a really good pickup opportunity as well. We've got Bernie Moreno, then you've also got the Senate Majority Leader Dolan, and you've also got the Secretary of Treasury, a guy named Frank LaRose, that are running in that race, and that's going to be one of the more competitive Republican primaries across America when it comes to the Senate races.
I always find the state of Arizona, Scott, to be very fascinating politically. It certainly was last year in 2022, but they have a Senate race coming up next year as well. And once again, a little bit interesting there.
Yeah, well, I think everybody remembers when Kerry Lake ran for governor last cycle. It was a close race, a lot of uncertainty who was going to ultimately win that, and she did lose a very, very tight race. She is looking at running for the United States Senate. Again, no declaration has been made in this race, but she would definitely be a front runner if she ran, and very, very difficult to defeat in a Republican primary given her popularity and close ties to President Trump. Listen, this is a race that's kind of interesting because Kyrsten Sinema became an independent, and a Democrat representative named Ruben Gallego, he decided to get in the race. And there's a lot of speculation whether the Democrats are going to chop votes in half and Sinema takes some of those independent votes from the Democrat. And then you have a Republican lane to run through. And so Arizona is a pickup opportunity because of those dynamics. It's a little bit different than last cycle when we had a close race with Blake Masters against Senator Kelly. But that's one we're definitely keeping our eyes on and we're excited about. That'll be a late primary for the summer of 2024. And then ultimately a big, big competitive race for the general election. You have other states like Nevada. Sam Brown is running there, and he'd be a strong candidate to be on the general election ballot. Then you go over to a state like Wisconsin that a lot of people think should be a pickup opportunity. That's where the Republican National Convention is going to be. That's where our first Republican presidential debate was located. And Wisconsin should be on the map, right? But the problem in Wisconsin is they can't find a top-tier candidate to get in that race yet. There's been a couple folks like Mike Gallagher that has officially taken a pass on it. So we're watching that state very, very closely.
I'd like to, before we run out of time here, Scott, talk about the Senate race in the Old Dominion, your state of Virginia. I think you have a bit of an interest in that race, don't you?
Yeah, well, I've told the listeners back in April that I declared on April 3rd for that race. It's been a lot of fun over the last 4.5 months to be a candidate for the United States Senate, been honored by the support that I've received from other Virginians. We've been traveling in every corner possible and just meeting folks and trying to listen and hear what they think the big issues in 2024 are going to be. And even as I travel throughout the country and try to raise money, the similar themes emerge for 2024. We know that there's a big parents' rights movement in Virginia, especially in Northern Virginia, to try to ensure that parents have a voice in the classroom with their kids' education.
Well, we certainly are going to keep an eye on the race in Virginia and U.S. Senate races all around the country with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a word or two about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to learn about the candidates the Club for Growth PAC has endorsed, check them out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
China's government-run economy is beginning to crumble as the folly of central management becomes more and more apparent. For details, we turn now to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Amid a surge in youth unemployment, China's government made some headlines last week by announcing that it would simply no longer publish official government data about how many young workers can't find jobs. They're just not going to show anyone that information. But not all of the country's economic woes can be so easily just swept under the rug. Hi folks, I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. China's industrial policy seems to be failing, and American policymakers should take notice of this because it's been panic over China's rapid economic growth, or maybe admiration of it, a little bit of both, that has fueled all manner of big government proposals in recent years. And those proposals look pretty foolish if China isn't a place that we should be worried about or a country that we should be admiring. In fact, it seems maybe like we should be pitying China instead, because China's economic model, which has leaned so strongly into industrial policy and top-down investments directed by Beijing, is broken and has left the country drowning in debt and running out of things to build. Don't take my word for it. That's the way two reporters for the Wall Street Journal put it in a must-read feature that was published on Sunday. The red flags in China, yes, pun intended, include some well-known factors like the country's demographic issues, which is, of course, a direct consequence of another government-led attempt at engineering society, the one-child policy. there are also less obvious failings caused by malinvestments, caused by bad decisions from the top. One example of the latter is a high-speed rail station in Danzhou, a city in China's southern province, which cost $5.5 million to build but has never been put into use because passenger demand is too low. Another example in the journal article is from Guizhou, one of the poorest provinces in the country, where the GDP per capita is less than $7,200 per year. That province has 11 airports, which is more than China's four biggest cities have. So now, just like in the U.S., you know, bridges to nowhere, airports that have no use, and useless high-speed rail projects, these things are all a sign of an infrastructure policy that's driven by politics rather than economics. In China, the national and local governments have borrowed heavily to fund construction projects that goose economic growth. It's an approach that some in Beijing are now privately admitting has reached its limits, again, according to the Wall Street Journal. With that old model reaching its end, it would make a lot of sense for China to pursue another phase of liberalization, moving towards a freer economy with a focus on consumer spending and service industries, but that clashes with President Xi Jinping's vision. Instead, the government is now scaling up another round of industrial policy focused on semiconductors, artificial intelligence, and direct government spending on cultural items like sporting events. And here's the real kicker. The journal reports that, quote, leadership also worries that empowering individuals to make more decisions over how they spend their money could undermine state authority without generating the kind of growth Beijing desires. That line does a pretty great job of summing up what's gone wrong in China. There's no doubt that governmental stimulus spending can drive economic growth higher over the short term, but the bill eventually comes due in the form of higher debt and wasted resources. Sustainable long-term economic growth doesn't come from officials issuing edicts. It comes from the individual's power to pursue their own needs and desires in the marketplace, even if some of those needs and desires aren't aligned with what the government wants. This is a difficult lesson for politicians everywhere to learn, as Americans certainly know. Whether China's leaders can learn it quickly might determine the future of the world's second biggest economy. But there's a lesson in all of this for American policymakers, too, because as I said at the top, panic over China's rapid economic growth has fueled all manner of big government proposals in recent years. That includes calls for amping up industrial policy and infrastructure spending, most obviously, but that's not it. The specter of China has also shown up in debates about whether the federal government should regulate online speech, whether it should subsidize American drug manufacturing, and whether it should control how Americans invest in businesses abroad. This is a bipartisan phenomenon. I mean, just take a look at former President Donald Trump, who was obsessed with using tariffs to curb China's growth, even though that mostly just added costs on American businesses and consumers. President Joe Biden can't stop talking about how China is, quote, eating our lunch when he's pitching plans to expand government spending. We've also heard Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently pick up a similar talking point. But more attention should be paid to the weaknesses in China's economic model, which are becoming more difficult to ignore on both sides of the Pacific. China's leaders have bet heavily on the misguided notion that government-directed investment is the key to greater economic growth. American officials should be in no rush to follow China down that path, a path that requires curtailing liberty to chase a little temporary stimulus. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of what's going on in D.C. and around the rest of the country this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump has the right to a speedy trial, but he also has a right to having adequate time to prepare his defense. As we learn from Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
With four multi-count indictments already filed against Donald Trump and the near certainty of still more to come, how will those trials be scheduled? None of the charging authorities thus far has argued for a trial date after the 2024 election. We're already in the 2024 election season, so the proposed scheduling of all of these trials will be within the presidential campaign season. The right to a speedy trial is guaranteed in the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The portion of that amendment that refers to the right to a speedy trial reads as follows. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. That provision is intended to prohibit long periods of incarceration or other penalties prior to a trial to determine guilt or innocence. The right to a speedy trial is thus designed to protect the defendant. But what if the defendant does not want a speedy trial? Does the defendant have the right to delay a trial? And if so, on what grounds? Mr. Trump almost certainly wants to delay every one of these trials against him, and many have speculated that one reason he wants to delay them is that he could possibly win the presidency and then simply pardon himself for all of the federal crimes of which he's been accused. But there's a simpler rationale for delaying every one of them until after the election, and that is that he wants to have his schedule free to campaign, not be tied up in court. Also, he can continue to protest his innocence while campaigning, thus giving those inclined to vote for him the issue of presumed innocence. If he were convicted of one or more crimes prior to the election, many voters in the political middle that will determine the outcome of the race would presumably shy away from voting for a freshly convicted felon. If Mr. Trump wants to delay one or more trials, there's another part of the Sixth Amendment that he may turn to his advantage. That is the right to an adequate representation. Over the years since the Constitution and its Sixth Amendment were adopted, the right to counsel has been expanded and clarified. Most people with only a passing knowledge of the legal process are familiar with the concept of the right to an attorney. That right implies an effective attorney. And in Strickland v. Washington in 1984, the Supreme Court adopted a two-pronged test of adequacy. In three separate subsequent Supreme Court cases, in 2015, 17, and 19, that right was further defined as including a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. That's the point on which I believe the Trump defense team will base its argument for more time, that the number of trials, the time necessary to prepare adequate defenses to each of a myriad of charges, and the legitimate need of defendant Trump to be able to campaign effectively for the highest office in the land rather than be tied up in court will be combined to form a credible argument for delay of some, if not all, of the cases. Even before making that argument in each of who knows how many cases, there's the matter of removing some of the charges associated with his acts as President of the United States from state courts to federal courts. These objections will be time-consuming to adjudicate in the Georgia case alone. Our legal system is designed to help protect the rights of defendants, not to grease the wheels of justice for the prosecution to get to trial as quickly as possible. Each judge will need time to decide whether the request to delay is justified or not, and each loss, regardless of which side loses, will probably be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. The only thing that can stop them is a series of plea deals on the Trump side that would include a commitment to drop out of the presidential race. If Mr. Trump determines that he could not win and thus could never pardon himself, don't be surprised if he cuts such a deal. And if that happens, remember, you heard it here first. This has been Colin Hanna for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KIZA-FM in Verde Valley, Arizona, KGZP-FM in Prescott, Arizona, and KJZK-FM in Kingman, Boulder City, Nevada. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.